I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Innovation is now viewed as America's economic salvation. Every urban leader is trying to figure out how to get more of it. And they couldn't find a better advisor than Richard Lester. As founding director of the Industrial Performance Center at MIT, he has led major studies of regional innovation performance, and he co-authored Innovation, The Missing Dimension on Sources of Creativity and Innovation. Also with us is innovative and serial entrepreneur Robin Chase, founder of Zipcar. With her latest company, GoLoco, she hopes to jumpstart ride-sharing in America. We'll talk to Richard Lester and Robin Chase about innovation today on Smart City. But first, this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Richard Lester is the founding director of the Industrial Performance Center and a professor of nuclear science and engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He has led major studies of national and regional productivity, competitiveness, and innovation performance. His book on the sources of creativity and innovation in advanced economies was published by Harvard University Press. Creativity and innovation are now viewed as our economic saviors, the sources of our adjustment to the global economy. Do you agree?
I do agree. They are not a panacea. That is, even the most creative, innovative region may not succeed in the global economy if it doesn't find a way to capture at least some of the benefits that are generated by creativity and by innovation. But without those things, places, regions, cities will find themselves in that race to the bottom that I think is what everybody is most afraid about when it comes to globalization.
And how does a community or a region capture the benefits of creativity and innovation?
I think part of the answer to that requires us to think a little bit about the innovation process. And of course, when we think about it, we think about people coming up with great ideas and maybe developing great business plans around those ideas and finding financing and so on. Those are important stages in the innovation process. But I think what's equally important is the take-up of innovative ideas and concepts and products and services. That is, a region or a city is going to be innovative as much because of its, and maybe even more, because of its capacity to take up ideas and concepts and products and services that have been developed wherever they have been developed, as it is because of its capacity to generate those ideas itself. And so we do need to think about the capacity of places to absorb and take up and use productively ideas wherever they first emerged.
This is such an interesting area, not much talked about in economic development. So I want you to talk about it. How do you develop, how does a community develop the capacity to take up or absorb ideas? What are the conditions that must be present to allow a community to do that?
Well, I don't think that there's a magic bullet, and I don't think that the same answer would work for every community. I think it depends where they're coming from, the legacy that they bring to the whatever the current situation is. So I don't want to claim that there's a single answer to your question, but I do think that one part of the answer for any community is that somewhere in that community there must be what I've come to call public space, where people from different institutional backgrounds, different backgrounds in terms of their education, can interact, maybe virtually, maybe physically, and conduct conversations, again, maybe virtually, maybe physically, about the direction of new technology, about the direction that markets are going in. And those conversations, it seems to me, the capacity to have those conversations, which may not actually be, you know, face-to-face conversations, seems to me to be really central to the ability of communities to be innovative and as we've been saying, central to their capacity to absorb and take up new ideas and new concepts. So I think that's one important part of the answer. There are other parts too, but I would emphasize to begin with that one.
Let's say, Richard, you were invited to speak to a mayor of a Midwest city, and let's say it was part of the Rust Belt, had a decline, had depended on manufacturing, which was now in decline. And you said to that mayor, you need to provide public space, virtual or physical, where people can interact, conduct conversations. It's very important, mayor, that you have in your community the capacity to have conversations. And the mayor said, okay, Richard, I buy that. What do I do?
Well, again, of course, it depends on the city, it depends on the mayor. But I think one of the things that I would suggest to that mayor would be that if he or she has in the city or in the region a university or a higher education institution more generally, that very often that kind of institution can be the site. Again, you know, we have to think more than just physically about this, but higher education institutions, universities, can offer many things to communities. But one of the most important things they can offer, and I think one of the most underappreciated things, not only by mayors, but by people in the universities themselves, is this ability to serve as a kind of public space for these kinds of these kinds of conversations. So I think the first thing I would say would be look at the higher education structure in the community and think about ways that it might play more of a role in this regard.
And when you think about universities, so many of them are still closed in on themselves. I mean, they're very insider ball game there. When you think about providing places for conversations, do you see the need to bring people of varying backgrounds, varying experiences together, varying capabilities? I'm wondering how the university, if that's necessary, and you tell me if it is, then I'm wondering how the university serves that role.
Well, it is true. What you say is true, that universities often are, or at least are perceived as being inward-looking institutions that sort of turn in on themselves. But what's also true, I think, is that the pressures are building on them, not just here in the U.S., but really around the world, to play a more active role, to engage more in their local and regional communities, very often in an economic dimension, and one of the advantages that they have, and I think this is something that actually many companies are coming to appreciate or have learned to appreciate, is that they are actually themselves quite heterogeneous institutions. They are open, and the American research universities are probably among our most open institutions in the sense of being open to influences and in the sense of gathering on their campuses people, students, faculty, researchers of various kinds who come from all over the world. And just by virtue of who is on campus, there is an ability to host, if you like, the kinds of conversations that companies need in order to become smarter about what's going on in their worlds, than often the companies are capable of conducting themselves. So, you know, why do companies come to universities? Well, sometimes it's because they want particular problems solved that they have with a product or a service, and there's a technical issue, and they know that there's a specialist in an area that's relevant to that problem, and they'll come and look for that specialist and ask for a very particular kind of result. But in other cases, what the company really wants to be part of is a kind of an open-ended discussion about where things are going in a technology that may or may not be central at the moment to their business, but may become so in the future. And they want to be part of that. And they know that, because the university has a convening capability, because it brings people from all over the place to work on problems, they can actually be part of a much more open-ended and sort of diverse conversation than they could ever host themselves.
In your study of innovation, Richard, have you found a difference in the value of physical space versus virtual space to innovation?
I do think that there are important differences here. One of the things that, of course, has happened over the last couple of decades is the we've had this extraordinary increase in the ability to communicate over long distances, very complicated, large amounts of information. But the kind of information that the internet and so on is most good at communicating is information that has already been codified.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's very important, and much, if not most, of the information that we deal with is information that is codified. But in innovation, especially at the early stages of innovation, where you don't exactly know what the product is that you're trying to develop, and you don't exactly know what it is the customer wants, and the customer doesn't exactly know what he or she wants. And indeed, you know, the old adage that if you want to be a successful innovator, you listen to the voice of the customer. Well, you know, the customer may not have a voice. There may not even be a customer at all. And in those early stages of the innovation process, the kind of communication that goes on is very different from the transmission of codified information from one person to another. I mean, you could almost think of that as being a highly sophisticated form of Morse code. But what we're talking about here, I think, in the early stages of innovation is a kind of communication process where people are really ambiguous in what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may not know exactly what I'm trying to say, and you may have trouble deciphering what I'm trying to say, but you may say something that may make me understand myself better, and so on and on it goes. And out of those sort of inherently ambiguous, uncertain conversations, people are groping around trying to figure out how to understand each other. Out of those conversations, new ideas emerge. And what I would submit to you is that physical proximity is much more important for being able to sustain those kinds of conversations than it is for the communication of, you know, codified information. And those kinds of conversations are terribly important for innovation, because it's out of them that the genuinely new ideas come that then eventually will get turned into products and services.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Richard Lester. He's founding director of the Industrial Performance Center and professor of nuclear science and engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Richard, you've studied innovation at a local level, I think worldwide. Which are the most innovative regions in the world today?
Well, you know, obviously people, when they think of that question, they think about places that everyone has heard of, places like Silicon Valley, maybe, you know, the Boston area, and so on. And I think that we have still, despite the enormous amount of attention that's been given to those regions, you know, we still have an enormous amount to learn about how it happens there. But I think that it would be a mistake to think that the only model for innovative regions, the only model for how to be or how to have an innovative economy, is provided to us by places such as Silicon Valley and the greater Boston area, which do much better than most other places in terms of their measuring their success in commercializing new ideas and measuring their, you know, the number of new businesses created and so on. I think that our own research has suggested that there are a number of different ways in which regions can be innovative. For example, you were talking earlier about the canonical Midwestern city whose manufacturing industry has fallen upon hard times. You know, there are interesting cases around the world of cities that have and communities that have indeed gone through very hard times, but have found ways to take the underlying technical knowledge or perhaps the underlying market knowledge that was there in the old industry but no longer really has much of a future in that industry, but to transform it, to sort of redirect it into the development of new industries, technologically related but different from what was there before. That I would think of also as a creative, innovative community. And I would add, if I may just say, that even in communities that have industries that aren't going away, that are sort of struggling along, but find ways to upgrade the products and services that those existing mature industries are producing, that too is a creative kind of location.
Which locations come to mind when you think about these interesting cases, these unexpected or unrecognized cases of innovation?
Well, there are a number of examples. Let me give you just one because I think it makes the point very well. We in recent years have done quite a lot of work in Finland, and when people think about Finland, they tend to think about Nokia and cell phones and so on, and very high-tech activity. And of course, that's an important part of the Finnish economy. But what people may not know about Finland is that it also has a fairly strong traditional industrial sector built around, initially around forest products, agricultural products. And one location in Finland, one city in Finland called Tampere, known as the Manchester of Finland after the northern industrial city in England, was the center of industrial machinery in Finland. And it did very well for many decades, exporting its products, particularly to neighboring Russia, the Soviet Union. But of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed economically and politically in the early 1990s, its markets basically disappeared. And here was this city that, you know, in terms of Rust Belt cities, it was facing a decline greater, at least in percentage terms, than anything probably that our Midwestern Rust Belt cities had to confront during that period because of its extremely strong dependence on the Soviet Union. But over the past 10 to 15 years, that community has found a way to not walk away from its industrial machinery industry, but upgrade it by infusing new technology, new ideas for services, and now boasts or can boast six or eight world-leading industrial machinery companies, now greatly enhanced in their product and service offerings through the infusion of new technologies, including information technologies, communications technologies, wireless technologies. You have these extraordinary forest machines, tree-cutting machines that sort of crawl around the forest with nobody in them, you know, cutting trees down and marking them, and it's all barcoded and, you know, operated by somebody a long way away. It's a very high-tech version of a very traditional mature industry. That's innovation, just as Silicon Valley and East Cambridge is innovation.
And did that come from within the existing companies, or did that come from some external organization or drive?
I think it was a combination. Some of the old companies in that community didn't make it. They went out of business. Other ones stayed alive. There was a lot of restructuring, not quite of the kind that we tend to see over here, because there's a little bit more of a cultural resistance to U.S.-style restructuring in Finland. But what was also very important, especially in to the technological upgrading of these firms' offerings, were contributions that were made by local universities and by national and regional technology agencies that operated public research institutions, which in along with the universities were playing a very important role in this story, have played a very important role in this story.
Richard, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It's my pleasure.
Richard Lester is founding director of the Industrial Performance Center at MIT. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planeta's and assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Downtown revitalization seems to be on the agenda of nearly every big city in the U.S. And with the recent boom of condo conversions and high-rise apartment buildings, the strategy of most cities follows the mantra that if you build it, they will come. But one city is skeptical about the wisdom of that approach. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram reports that Mansfield, Texas is looking to revitalize its historic downtown by bringing the people before the development, by hosting downtown events aimed at highlighting the area's features and drawing in economic activity. For this suburb of Fort Worth and Arlington, the first step toward development is building a customer base. If they come, then the city will build it. Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, state officials are looking at ways of preserving the population base they already have. But in Pennsylvania, this population base is only temporary. With more than 250 colleges and universities, the state leads the nation in attracting out-of-state college freshmen. But it also feels the sting as many of those students run for the border after graduating. So the state has begun offering millions of dollars in grants for research, and millions more in tax credits for new companies. According to the Wall Street Journal, the state hopes that by encouraging companies to grow in the state, there will be enough attractive jobs to keep students after they receive their degrees. Cities have also joined the push by touting their relative affordability, especially when compared to major job markets in New York and Los Angeles. And finally, new census figures have revealed that despite rising gas prices and increasing distances between work and home, more and more people are commuting alone. By 2005, the percentage of people driving alone had increased to more than 77% of all commuters, and the percentage of carpoolers dropped from nearly 13% in 2000 to just below 11% in 2005. But the U.S. Census Bureau reports that carpooling has shown some increases in rural and agricultural areas, like Fresno, California, and Mesa, Arizona. And despite reported increases in ridership nationwide, less than 5% of commuters ride public transit to work, a rate that has remained relatively stagnant over the past 5 years. However, these figures are all from 2005, when the average gas price was $2.28, with the national average over $3 a gallon in 2007. Many are expecting big changes in the next rounds of census data. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Robin Chase started Zipcar in 1999. Today, the hourly rental service has 50,000 users in 10 cities. Now with Go Loco, Robin aims to do for carpooling what she did for car sharing, make it hip. Robin, you've now started two companies devoted to car and ride sharing, first Zipcar and now Go Loco. What is the source of your obsession with this topic?
I've become recently more obsessed over the last 2 years as I watched climate change and the issues related. Cars contribute 20% of our CO2 emissions in this country and our personal cars. So it's something that has huge meaning to me. We have a very short timetable in which to accomplish something. And when I started Zipcar, I hadn't been in transportation before, but I realized transportation is the center of all things. You know, it's the glue that holds the rest of our society together. So it really is a very fascinating topic.
Explain your concept for Go Loco.
So Go Loco, we take your personal social networks and we enable you to turn those into car ride-sharing networks. And the idea is that we all have our social networks, people we feel comfortable with, and they have a lot of context around them, our communities and groups, people we know. And it's one of the barriers to doing ride-sharing, that we don't want to get in cars with strangers. So we have put social networks on a very easy matching and posting ride-sharing system. And then the third leg of this is that we enable an online payment system from passengers to riders for their share of the car costs if a person wants to share those costs.
And how do you price it? Is the pricing all driven by the driver?
The pricing is driven by the driver as well as the market. We set a default rate so people have an idea, because I think no one has really a clue how expensive it is to drive. It costs the average person $8,000 a year to run their car, and it comes down to about 50 cents a mile. So we set that as a benchmark rate. People can also can adjust that up or down. They can add parking or tolls. And the system also allows you to share car rental or taxis to and from conferences, for example. And then you would set everything to zero with putting in the other field, you know, $30 for taxi and tips. And you can share that.
Do people really have personal networks big enough to make this work when you think about the many different places people need to go? I mean, there's no predicting anymore how people are sort of spread across the landscape and where they need to go during the course of a day, which one of the things that makes transit provisions so difficult. I'm wondering if your personal network really works as a transportation network.
I think in the beginning, we need to think of that as the nub, that your personal network does act as a transportation network. And over time, as this network becomes large, then, of course, it would be expanding more broadly. But if we think about your personal network is slightly expansive. If you go into work and someone turns out to be going to a meeting across town, you may never have seen that person before. But the fact that they belong to your work gives you a source of comfort, and you would say, absolutely, let's go for a ride together. So when we think of our personal networks, there's the people that you know personally firsthand, and then there's a whole realm of people with whom you're comfortable, people that you work with, that go to the same church as you, that you see in the gym all the time, that are in your child's school, in your church. All of those create a much larger network. And then on the top of that, we can also tell you where there's an overlap. I might not know you firsthand, but we have a friend in common named Reese. So I can see who we share in common, what groups we share in common, what interests, and that expands that bond.
Do I have to first populate my personal network online before I can participate, or is there a way for me to go as an individual with no personal network to say I'm going from here to there on a regular basis and I'm looking for someone to ride with?
I'm going to be tricky in my answer. We launched 6 weeks ago, and so I'd say today the likelihood of you saying I want to go from here to there and finding someone to go with is relatively slim. I still want you as an individual to post that trip, because now it's sitting out there to say, you know, every Monday through Friday I leave around 8 a.m. and I return around 6 p.m. And that, as a posting, is just sitting out there. And one day when someone comes and has that exact same route, you'd get an email. And at that moment, you could say, you know, today it doesn't work for me, or I don't know you, I don't want to go with you. Or you could say, hey, that looks swell, let's make a match. But as to, I think it's much more satisfying to think about it and populate your network as best as you can. So you would, you know, tell your coworkers, hey, this is a cool thing. You would talk to your group of, I've created groups within my own network, so people I know who are really interested in gardening, and we have created a group, invited those people. And when I go to the distant nursery, I can, with one shot, say, I'm going to the nursery, and that gets emailed out to all the people who said they were interested in going to nurseries. And so I'm populating my network and then getting satisfaction from that. Or, you know, my group of friends with whom I go to the movies, or going to baseball games. Who are your friends that like to go to baseball games, and divide the cost of that parking among all of you? So it is it's a two-part thing that people have to do: post their common roots and try and invite people today. Over time, you know, these groups will grow and overlap, and it will be, I see the future of us, you know, getting out of the mall and looking at, and using our cell phone to say, wow, there's 40,000 cars in this parking lot. I bet one of them in the next 5 minutes is going right close to my house. And you would be able to say, I want to ride. And someone would say, I'm going that way. But we have to get from here to there.
How many people do you estimate have to participate in a local market to make Go Loco work?
Again, I would go back to this particular group issue. Between me and my best friends, I get my best friends, and I'm very satisfied that when I say, I'd like to go to a movie Thursday night, who wants to come, instead of me calling each one of my friends one by one and having them decide whether they're being mean to Robin by saying no, or, hey, yeah, I'd love to go. I'm very satisfied with that I invited my friends, and I'm completely satisfied. Or we're working with a number of churches that are interested in climate change, and I think those churches and parishioners are satisfied. They've invited their own community that goes to and from the church on Sunday mornings, and they're completely satisfied. Let me tell you an interesting story of how it might work. 3 weeks ago, when the company was only 3 weeks old, I was speaking at a conference outside of Washington, D.C. in Columbia, Maryland. And so, of course, being the CEO and founder of this company, of course, I had to post that trip. So I booked my plane ticket first, and then I booked a rental car, and then I posted this trip from the airport to Columbia, Maryland. The likelihood of my finding a match, I would say, in my mind was very close to zero, because we'd only been out for 3 weeks, and who in heck would be taking this obscure little route? And the morning before my flight, I got an email that said someone would like to join your trip, and I could hardly believe it. You know, I can't believe someone wants to go from National Airport to Columbia, Maryland. And the person wrote a note that said they were attending the International Wireless Conference at Loyola College. And when this man wrote this, I could see, hey, he's going to the same conference I'm going to. That means he's one of 150 people that I've never met. I've met four of those people, but he's not one of the people I happen to know. So already my level of confidence was larger. Then I could click through his profile to see who he is, and I found that he worked for the World Resources Institute, and I could tell that because he was put into that community from his email address. I only could see WRI.org, and I knew, I like that institution, and I have comfort with that. And then he had put what his personal blog was, which was Embark at WRI.org. And Embark is WRI's sustainable transportation arm, and I know his two bosses. So it gave me, there wasn't a moment's doubt in my mind that, of course, I would be happy to go with Reese on this trip. So that illustrates, you know, here was a long shot, and I knew nothing about this man, and I'm not interested in driving with strange men any more than anyone else is. But I, through the system, I was able to have extreme comfort. There wasn't a moment worry in my mind when I was meeting Reese at the car rental that he was going to be someone I wouldn't enjoy a ride with. And in fact, we did enjoy the ride.
I want to go back to your example you used of the of going to the movies. I hadn't thought about Go Loco as any more than a transportation ride-share system, but one of the things you seem to be pointing out is it's also a way not only of sharing transportation, but getting people to go along with you to the movies. There's a certain companion element to this. I mean, did you anticipate that?
Yes, I did. If we think of all the social things that we do in our lives, it's focused around the destination. You know, let's go to the Red Sox game, let's go to the movies, let's meet up at a restaurant. And there isn't any reason why that shouldn't be brought back out to the point of origin. I have a 13-year-old daughter who does rock climbing, and she has a choice that I could drive her directly to the rock gym, or she could drive in the van with 10 of her friends to and from the rock gym. The van, amazingly, takes her half an hour longer each way, and every single time she wants to go in the van because part of her experience at the rock gym is being in the van with her 10 friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is that way. Another Go Loco trip I took was with a woman friend of mine to one of these nurseries, and she had seen my posting and thought to herself, oh, I was going to go next weekend to the nursery. Robin's going tomorrow. I'll go with her. And it was amusing to me in the car because she was saying that we hadn't seen each other for 6 weeks. She had never thought this service was going to be for her, and how much fun it was that we got to go in the car together, gossip the entire way there, you know, talk about plants, come back. And it was a really pleasant additive part of my day. If you think about when you go to the grocery store and you bump into a neighbor, it's like a really pleasant thing. Hey, there's someone, you know, I know, and it's nice to chat with them. We can make that happen more often and more, you know, and start it way back more easily.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Robin Chase. She's founder of Go Loco. Robin, I'm curious about the biggest motivation to use a service like Go Loco or to rideshare. Is it gas prices? Is it parking problems? Is it the socialization you were just talking about? Is it the fact that people have no car? What is that motivation?
Every time I try to come back to the one motivation, and I think I've nailed which one it is that matters most, I am told, no, by another person, that's not it. So when I think I've just got it down that, you know, riding, going places with your friends and colleagues is the number one motivation, and I've understood that, I will get an email from someone who says, oh my God, thank goodness, this is the only way I can, it's all about the money, it's the only way I can reduce my car costs, I'm completely, you know, it just drives me crazy. There is this wonderful billboard a person made for us that we have not put up that said, you know, how to end vacant seat syndrome. And I think the money really does matter. The average American spends 18% of their budget on their car. And we know that that price is going up. We know that fossil fuel prices are going up. Parking costs, cities and towns have gotten wise to the fact that parking is incredibly underpriced. And so they're increasing that price. The federal government has encouraged states to finance their highways with more road tolling. And so we're seeing more pressure there. And one day in the next few years, I imagine we'll be seeing carbon taxes. So that 18% of your income, which is already quite unbearable for people, which is why I think we see people feel the crisis when fossil fuel prices go up, because we're already feeling this burden of 18%. That is going to be going up to 22, 25% of your income. And if we think of Americans across the country, they are in a crisis. They really don't have any choice. How they're dependent on their cars. They don't have any other options. And this is where Go Loco, I think, is such a brilliant answer to them. You know, what can they personally do to reduce their costs of car travel? And here's something that you can do that is very easy and can make a dent. You know, if we think of the price of gas going up, you know, some percentage, if we each shared one car trip a week, that would reduce our cost by 5%. So it's not a big drama. And the last recent reason, I think, again, to why people are going to join, I think some people will join because they're yearning to do something about their own CO2 footprint, and they don't know how to go about it. You know, if you are concerned about reducing emissions, this is the single largest way that you can reduce your carbon footprint. As I say, cars produce, our personal cars are 20% of the U.S. emissions. The next largest thing that we as individuals do to produce CO2 emissions is our residential electric bill, and that's 15% of U.S. emissions. And think of all the different appliances and uses that go into that 15% and compare it to the 20% on the car. So sharing rides is a way that you can get at that 20% quickly, easily. You don't have to make any investment. You don't have to buy, you know, a hybrid. You don't have to wait years until you can change your job or move closer to town. This you can do tomorrow, and it makes a significant impact.
What did you imagine your users' biggest concerns to be?
I know what it is. It's all around this issue of safety. And that was one of the things that why I felt that we were at this perfect moment, and why I seized the, you know, why I finally thought the time for Go Loco has come. While we do have these major trends going on that we've talked about in terms of cost and CO2 emissions, the rise of social networks have pointed the way to make us not have anxiety about riding with strangers. That we now have Facebook and LinkedIn and MySpace, and Facebook in particular demonstrates the way in which I can see a lot about, you know, who my friends are, who their friends are, what they say about each other, what I say about myself, what my photograph is, and these are all things we've incorporated. And it gives you a level, it gives you context to have a ride board that says, Robin wants to go to Columbia, Maryland. Who in heck is Robin? You really want to know lots of things about me in order to have the comfort. It's the same way that we make a decision to ride with someone, get a ride home from work. You know, if you're at a meeting or downtown or any place that you want to ride and someone offers that ride, you're looking at that person and looking at their social context, and that's the basis on which you make that decision. And so we offer that up. We also have a couple other things, rather, like eBay, that you can, each person is encouraged to write about the person that they rode with. And so you can say what you thought about me, and therefore I will probably be on my best behavior when I'm with you. I will try not to talk too much like I'm doing now. We also have a rating system where it says Robin Chase 4 out of 4, and it means of the 4 people I have physically been in a car with, all 4 of them have said that they would ride with me again. Mm-hmm. So every time I ride with someone new, I get asked the question, would I ride with that person again? And that's a very powerful statistic because it's very close to home. I can't game that system. I can't, you can't really, with Facebook, people become friends incessantly. You know, I friend everyone who comes along. This way, I'm saying I personally would be happy to ride with that person again, and I had to be in a car with them in order to make that judgment.
You've been up and running 6 weeks. Where is the service most active?
Since we're centered in Massachusetts, it's most active here. We have about half of the people who've signed up are in Massachusetts, and half of them are not. So I feel and note profoundly that it is indeed something that there is a yearning for across the country. And the other interesting thing is that about half the trips posted are commute trips and half are non-commute trips. And
that's interesting. Commute to work.
Yeah. And what's intriguing about that is while we all focus on our commute to work, that is actually only 20% of the trips we take in life, which I found kind of shocking when I first learned this statistic. But we're seeing this 50% around those commute trips because it's something that you do every day on a regular, relatively planned basis. Mm-hmm. The other 50% are people doing all sorts of things. And one of the lovely parts about this, about Go Loco, is that on your personal homepage, it says, where can I go loco in the next few days? And you'll see chronologically, you know, 7 a.m., 7:15, 8, 9, 10, and then a destination assigned. And then if a friend of mine or a community of mine is writing that, I can see that we have this commonality. But when I look at this list, I can see all sorts of places that I forgot about going, that, oh, wow, you know, I could go to IKEA on Saturday. I hadn't thought of that. Or I can go to that museum outside, or I could go to the beach. You look at this list and you see a wealth of possibilities. You know, here's places I can go and people I can go with that I know mm-hmm. and I like in my communities. So it's a very, back to the social aspect, it's a very compelling view of the world. I don't ever have to be bored or lonely. There's a place to go and people to go with.
You are a serial entrepreneur. You started Zipcar. You've started GoLoco. Both of those services require a certain level of participation to make them work, I guess, in ways like any business. But, I mean, if I'm the only rider, or I'm the only person wanting a ride and no one's there to offer a ride, then GoLoco doesn't work. So you have to have a certain number of people participating, even if you're using your own personal network. I'm just curious, how, as an entrepreneur, have you been able to jumpstart these businesses? How do you get people excited about them from day zero?
It is the mind of an entrepreneur, ever optimistic. I feel that, you know, indeed, what you're saying is true. And when I started Zipcar, people were telling me it was never going to work because people adore their cars, Americans identify with them, it's never going to work. But I had a profound belief that for some people who live in major cities, the costs of car ownership outweighed the benefits, and therefore they were desperately seeking alternatives. And so likewise with GoLoco, I can see a path from where we are today to this future of this being the ubiquitous form of transportation. But I believe profoundly that there are people for whom the costs of car ownership are a really big problem and who have really big incentives to make it happen for them. And I think painting the vision and branding is really what's really very important about it. With Zipcar, which is renting cars by the hour and by the day, I could have said to people, hey, you know what? You're going to sell your car, and I'm going to put one car on every four blocks. I'll put a car, and 18 to 50 of you are going to share that car. All right, you ready? Like, no one would sign up for that. But instead, we said, this is way cheaper than owning your own car. You only pay as you use it. You can drive a different car every day of the week. So likewise with GoLoco, you know, we could give a very negative and arm-twisting rationale for why you should do it. Or we can say, you know what, there's a huge amount of benefits in this for you today that you personally would enjoy it and stand to gain. You can spend more time with your friends. You can save money. You can feel much better about your contribution to the environment. And we can make it a cool, hip, fun thing.
Robin, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Robin Chase is founder of GoLoco. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Still think nice guys finish last? City View's commentator Walker Smith begs to differ.
Being nice is making a comeback. NBC's hit sitcom, My Name is Earl, is about Earl Hickey, a petty thief and all-around bad guy turned good, who is trying to right every wrong he has done in his life. After being hit by a car moments after he won $100,000 in the lottery, Earl believes he has fathomed a fundamental lesson of karma, that you reap what you sow. So, he made a list of all the bad things he's done, and on each episode, he picks one item on his list to set things right again. Earl is in good company on network TV these days. Even American Idol, which generates much of its appeal through the relentless ridicule and derision it heaps on lesser talents, has shown a softer side lately. Over $60 million for American and African children in poverty was raised during a special Idol Gives Back show, during which no one was voted out of the competition. Advertisers are starting to tap into this vein of cordiality, too. The tagline for Hilton Hotels' current TV ad campaign is Be Hospitable. Every ad shows strangers helping strangers through random acts of kindness. The backstory to this year's Super Bowl centered on the coaches, Tony Dungy for the Indianapolis Colts and Lovie Smith for the Chicago Bears. Bigger than the story that both were African American, a first in Super Bowl history, was the story that both are the antithesis of what people expect from successful pro football coaches. They don't win Vince Lombardi style. They win while being nice. Now, this is not to suggest that selfishness and sarcasm have lost popular appeal. It is only to note that all of a sudden, kindness and civility have popped up in places rarely seen. Being mean can even get you fired nowadays, as Don Imus discovered. Imus has said lots of inappropriate, racially and sexually charged things in the past. It's just that in jeering at the Rutgers women's basketball team, he picked on a group of decent, nice, irreproachable women who had done nothing to deserve his mean treatment, unless you count playing hard enough to be the spoiler in the 2007 NCAA women's basketball tournament. Being mean put Imus over the top. In contrast, by denouncing the quote-unquote psychodrama of the baby boom generation, and by allying himself with a return to quote-unquote trust and fellow feeling, Senator Barack Obama has become a leading candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. We can't say goodbye to acrimony and mean-spiritedness quite yet. We are far too jaded to drop our guard. But the distrust, ambition, egotism, and apathy that have put such a hard edge on contemporary life are wearing thin. Showing more selflessness and generosity of spirit by being nice is an emerging mark of distinction. That's what's scarcest nowadays. So that's the new sign of status and success. Indeed, it's something we can all claim as our own, because it's something as easy as just smiling back once a day at someone we would have scowled at before. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.